Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrats Dan Johnson and Dave Lundy, and Republicans Mike Miller and Chris Voronis. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Back home live tonight from our home base, and our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289, where our email address is btb@museum.tv, and where our web address is beyondthebeltway.com. And if you'd like to tweet us a question, you can go to @BTB Dumont, @BTB Dumont, and we will take questions from all, I guess, if we even had a carrier pigeon, we would probably take a question tonight from them, but we're not going to tell you exactly where we are in our location. We don't want a lot of pigeons around here. Anyway, nice to be back in Chicago. Nice to be back at our home base. We have lots to talk about, full 2 hours. It was a busy political week, but I want to start with Mike Miller, who is an economist, has been teaching the economics at DePaul University for many, many years. You have been consistent in warning us about the economic catastrophe that is tied with Obamacare. What is your reaction to the CBO report last week from the Congressional Budget Office that said that close to 2.3 million people could lose their job over several years because it's going to be a disincentive for people to work?
And no surprise whatsoever. What happens is when you impose this particular kind of connection between your income and the government giving you a benefit in terms of health care, as your income goes up, essentially you lose that benefit, which is just like your taxes going up. And there are several places where, for a family, you might go from working, earning $60,000 to $62,000. All of a sudden, you owe the government $10,000 more, or you owe that much more for your health care, which means all of the money between 62 and 72, you're taxed at a 100% rate. This will disincentivize people working harder.
Let's hear from Dave Lundy, one of our Democrats, your reaction to the report and whether or not the report is really political dynamite and a problem for Democrats.
Well, I think there is a meaningful distinction between the politics of the report and the substance of the report. And Bruce, respectfully, you did it too. You just did what the rest of the media did and talked about 2 million jobs lost. That's not what the report said. The report was not about the demand for labor. Even Mike will agree with that. The report was about the supply of labor. Right. And what's so interesting is that 5 years ago, when Obamacare was first being debated, Paul Ryan said, you know, one of the most important things we need to do about the health care reform is to eliminate job lock, to free people from the problem of having to keep a job in order to keep their health insurance. That's exactly what the CBO report focused on, is the flexibility that people will now have. It did not say that 2 million people are losing their job. That's just factually wrong.
What about the point of disincentive, that there's a disincentive to work hard?
Well, I don't think,
or longer.
Well, I think that if Republicans are saying, you know what, we really need to chain people to so that you can make that extra $2,000, then that's fine. But, you know, the CBO report also had some good news in it. It said the deficit would be cut. It said that, contrary to the other Republican talking point, which is that Obamacare has caused more people to go from full-time to part-time work, they said, on the contrary, there's no compelling evidence that that's true.
Chris Voronis is our other Republican. Chris, your reaction to the report and also to what Dave just said.
Well, it's clear, the more and more we examine Obamacare, it's clear that we just get layer and layer of mud that's been packaged in a silk stocking. This just latest revelation is frankly no surprise. It shows up in the president's approval ratings, which are like in the low 40s. About 39% of Americans say they trust him. I think you could draw a dotted line between those numbers and all the foibles of Obamacare, this just being the latest fiasco.
Dan Johnson also joins us. Dan, this is a program of a little bit about a process, but a lot about politics.
Yeah.
As a political document, as the way I summarize the report, which Dave took exception to, but I'm not alone in that description. You've certainly seen the Republicans, how they've responded to it. Does this now begin to continue to feed a narrative about Obamacare that really makes it such a toxic thing for any Democrat to try to cling to in an election year for members of Congress?
So from a political perspective, it fits into the broader narrative of Democrats always have a slightly longer explanation of how things actually work. And Republicans have this short bumper sticker explanation of how things don't work that way in reality, but sure sounds scary. So,
which idea wins campaigns?
Well,
bumper stickers or long explanations?
It depends how good our ad people are at making people pay attention to 30 seconds instead of 6.
There goes the Senate.
Right. Right. So if people pay attention for 30 seconds to say, gee, the report never said the lies they're spreading on Fox News that people are losing their jobs. Instead, what the report said is what Dave so aptly put.
But there were partisan Democrats on the Sunday shows today that were saying that they weren't backing away, that maybe we would be moving towards a more part-time workforce. But the way they spun it, this was Congressman Ellison, Keith Ellison from Minnesota, head of the Progressive Caucus. The way he was spinning it was, well, people are going to have more time to raise their children. What mother wouldn't want to be home raising her
Keith
children?
Keith Ellison was a little thick with that one. I didn't go for that either.
But were you gagging when you heard him say
yes.
that?
The White House's take on the CBO report is like a mayor of a town that got hit by a tornado saying, well, people have more fresh air and more sunlight now. I mean, that's basically how the White House took it.
I'll give you the 6 minutes if you want it. But, Dave, you were correct. And I'm going to come to Bruce's defense. He never said supply or demand, where the jobs are lost. Here's what happens.
He said job
losses.
Assume
you have X number of people working at any point in time. And what happens is I give you an incentive to draw your hours down by 1 hour per person in the economy. Add them all together, you get the 2.5 million people who are not working. It's not 2.5 people. It's 2.5 million equivalents.
Full-time equivalents.
Now, keep in mind, the long-run potential growth of the economy is comprised of how many people we have, how productive they are, and how many hours we work. If any one of those three go down, the long-run potential of the economy goes down. There is no doubt, therefore, if you give people incentive not to work as hard, you will have fewer people total in the labor force working X number of hours, and this will reduce long-run potential GDP.
Dan. So what the professor just said is we like forcing people to work longer than they otherwise would in order to keep their health insurance because the CBO report said people aren't going to be forced to take a full-time job that they might not otherwise want
to
keep their health insurance benefits.
You're focusing upon that one group of people that is locked. And I understand that job lock is a ridiculous thing. The Republicans from the beginning were saying, let's simply break away from employment and health care. It should be an open market, just like when we buy auto insurance and so forth.
That's true.
There's nothing locked here. Here's the problem. Let's say you have somebody who's making $20,000 a year, and what they would really want to do is make $30,000 a year. But in doing that, if they now have to pay for all of their health insurance, it could be therefore the marginal tax rate on that additional $10,000 is so high because of what they pay for their health insurance, there's no incentive to do it. There's no incentive for someone to do better.
That's not true. That's absolutely true.
The subject has been engaged. 1-800-723-8289 at BTB Dumont. If you want to tweet us a question, 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and David, during the break, you were laying out all the litany of things, how the Democrats are going to be, treating Republicans. Put some of them on the record.
I just was.
What do Republicans really want? They want everybody to work 40 hours and have two jobs, work 80 hours.
That seems to be where they're most comfortable, because according to the argument that my good friend Mike is making over here, he says, the overall productivity or the production of the economy is going to be down because people are going to work a little bit less, 2.5 million full-time equivalent hours. And what my position is that inherently a bad thing? Americans work more than any other industrialized economy. Right. We have less vacation than any other industrialized economy. We have less family leave. We have less personal leave. And this policy you know, might it result in a little bit less? Sure. It'll also result in a healthier populace, which will work more.
That's your that.
Go ahead.
The only thing I want to say is
the Democrats, starting with Keith Ellison, and now with everybody is talking about that life is going to be better if we work less.
Yes, and all I ask you to do is allow me to make that decision, not to be influenced by what the government does. The government, any government tax, to be most efficient, should have the minimum effect upon incentives to work and work hard. And what this does, unfortunately, it gets in the middle of that. Any policy you have with welfare or unemployment compensation, you want to minimize the chance that it undermines the incentive to work. Let me make the decision. Let a woman make the decision. Keep in mind, a woman goes back to work, and we want for women's rights. What if she's the one that takes the family income so high that all of a sudden they lose all of their benefits from the government, and therefore the marginal tax rate on her work is very, very high?
And that's exactly what we should focus on.
So what Mike is saying, so you're calling the lack of a subsidy a tax. So if you follow the Republican objection to Obamacare as it currently is, you're essentially saying we want more subsidies. Because what you're saying is if you make more money and the subsidy is less, well, I'm going to call that a tax increase.
I understand your point.
So what you're ultimately saying is we ought to make health insurance cheaper. And we want to get more subsidies for more people.
You have to finish the sentence of what comes after because. Everyone agrees job lock's not a good thing. But when you create this Rube Goldberg program rife with perverse incentives, people are going to leave the workforce because it's incentivized for them to do so. That's the problem that Republicans and fair-minded people have with the CBO report.
Well, they get a second job because it was talked to them. They were mentioned that the Democrats were saying, well, then somebody can get a second job if they want.
So good luck. I mean, look. Instead of creating this system of perverse incentives, how about grow the economy?
But the perverse incentives,
especially
you're
after 30 years, we're at a 30-year low of people leaving the economy, and right now Obamacare is stepping the gas pedal on more people leaving the economy. And Dan talks about narratives. You put this in a political context. Vulnerable Democrats, Mary Landrieu in Louisiana, Mark Pryor, Arkansas, Michigan,
nuts.
Montana. They're running scared because they have to defend this.
So you hear Republicans just say it's a Rube Goldberg contraption? Sounds
I didn't
like
say
they're
that.
Advocates
no,
of a single-payer health
exactly.
Medicare for all.
Say that.
Look at that. They're saying the subsidies aren't big enough.
No,
they're calling
that's not
that a
what
tax
we said.
Increase.
Look,
no,
don't put David.
But the other thing that Mike and I talked about during the break is, okay, what you're identifying, the incentive problem you're identifying, is that there's a hard stop at $61,000.
Right.
So would you say perhaps we should come up with a bipartisan approach to ease the subsidies out so that it's not a fixed cliff.
Anything
and
that
wouldn't
reduce,
that solve the problem?
That would certainly help.
Well,
but you see, that's the problem.
Why don't Republicans, instead of saying, let's repeal Obamacare for the 47th time that they passed through Congress,
you're not gonna get
let's
it right.
focus on fixing it, because we all agree there are problems. Anybody on our side of the aisle that would say that there are no problems.
It's funny, you
let's
didn't until 3 days ago, you did.
From a political standpoint, given where the country is, where the president's approval ratings, do you believe that for the rest of 2014, the Republicans running for re-election, some to the Senate, obviously everybody to the House, wide open, should they focus like a laser beam on Obamacare and this issue and forget all other issues that could be out there? Focus on it because at the moment it appears to be the rawest piece of meat they can throw not only to their constituents but to the broader voters.
Without question, and it's not just the CBO report, but just what about if you want to keep your doctor, you can. I mean, that was a lie heard around the world, on par with George Bush, read my lips. Yet Obama's not held accountable for that. And it was so clear.
Republican ad makers will try to hold him accountable.
Absolutely. But it was so clear from the get-go that the system was designed to throw people off of private insurance and into the exchanges.
Exchanges are private insurance.
That is an incoherent statement.
Subsidized. You've got these utilities that are set up by the federal government. Insurers are becoming quasi-utilities.
No, they're not at all. That's also just not true.
Dan, go ahead.
Look, the only difference is with the exchange is that now there's a website where you can compare apples to apples. And if that's creeping socialism, then sign me up with the red flag.
But there is one question.
I
mean, let's assume that by the end of the year, the insurance – I don't know if this is going to happen. What if the insurance companies lose exceptionally large quantities of money because the risk pool is all wrong?
No, you
it's
are
essentially
completely wrong. I was just
to,
reading an article about this. The head of Aetna, the head of two or three of the other major insurance companies are talking about the massive windfall that is coming their way thanks to Obamacare.
I hope so. But let me ask – but if – talking about utilities, if – there would be a massive loss. Are you prepared to bail out the insurance companies because you forced them into this situation?
And if winter continues through June, are you prepared to deal with the ice in June? It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous construct.
Not.
The insurance companies are saying, number one, they're saying the mix, the age mix is a little worse than they expected, but nothing that they can't handle. Number two, they're expecting a major new source of revenue that they did not otherwise have, and they sounded awfully confident about it.
Wasn't the age mix.
We're going to take some calls. Okay. Let's go to Matt in Carmel, Indiana, listening to us on XM Radio tonight. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I want to comment on the Democrats trying to have this both ways. I'm a small business owner, insure about 110 lives, and I can assure you that they've doubled down on the connectivity between group health insurance and work through two mechanisms. And number one, the mandate of, employing 50 or more people, you have to offer health insurance. And then number two, if you offer health insurance that's deemed affordable by the government, then your employee does not qualify for subsidies on the marketplace. So that ties him to your insurance. So, not to mention that when people got their policies canceled, that was seemingly a small fraction of society. Most people got their insurance, through their employer, blah, blah, blah. Now, it seems that now everybody's going to get to, work, when they want and retire at 57 and all this kind of stuff because they've got this thing. I just don't see how we have this both ways.
Did you?
And again, I'm incredulous that I have anything to do with offering health insurance to my employees. I am in metal fabricating. I have no expertise in that. I have learned it over the years, obviously. But, I come from a standpoint of I don't want to be involved in your health insurance. I would love to have it be a marketplace where we can all go buy it.
So, Matt, I'm just trying to follow your logic because I'm also a small business owner. And I also have people on health insurance, some of which are getting it through the exchanges. But I'm trying to understand. So is your main complaint that Obamacare is forcing people into an employer health insurance? Is that your main complaint?
Well, my complaint is this, is that from the political argument that the Democrats can't have it both ways, that I think they've doubled down on connecting health insurance to your job by imposing, the employer mandate. And then again, the marketplace insurance, if you don't qualify for a subsidy, which are generous, the subsidies, but if you don't qualify, it's expensive. If you're trying to put that on your own as compared to any portion of a subsidized employer plan. So I can't imagine that you have a citizen that has the luxury of saying, I don't want to work, that's going to qualify for some massive subsidy, in the marketplace, and I'm convinced they would find the insurance on the marketplace much more expensive than what they can get it through their employer.
So,
because employers subsidize health insurance usually to some degree, 75% maybe to 50%.
Matt, we're going to let Dan have the final word, and then we're going to move on. Dan?
I mean, it sounds – look, I agree with you on the point that employers shouldn't be in the business of offering health insurance. It's a stupid policy. I think Barack got it, pushed it as far as he could, but he couldn't get it over that hill back in 2010. I think it'd be a lot cheaper for everybody if everybody just got Medicare and we paid for it in taxes. But I guess it's a little incoherent to say at the first hand, gee, insurance is too expensive if you're on your own, and then – B, on the other hand, these subsidies are generous, but I don't like that we're spending so much money on them. I feel like if you're a small business owner and you don't like having to pay for health insurance for your employees, then you ought to be for Medicare for all and avoid the complications of trying to regulate a private health insurance industry.
Thinking of the benefits and these that you get these subsidies to buy the health insurance, and you don't want to lose that, so you go home and you say, I'm not going to work as many hours because I'm going to lose my government benefits. Who's paying for that? Who's paying that person that they can stay home? We are.
All the taxpayers. The person's choosing to have a lower standard of living.
No, see, if they would work harder, they would lose.
It's classic capitalism. If they choose to work fewer hours and make less money, that's their choice. But the whole notion that the only reason that somebody is working is to get health insurance, no, the idea is they may want to work a little bit less. They may want to spend a little more time in doing other things or starting a business. I mean, I think that this was so overblown because these are effects around the margin.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. 1-800-723-8029 is the phone number. If you'd like to tweet us a comment, it's at BTB Dumont. And it is time now to have our guests introduce themselves. And we start with Dave Lundy. Dave.
I'm Dave Lundy. I run a communications and public affairs strategy firm called Aileron that works mostly in the clean energy and early stage technology industry. I have a wife, Jen, and two fabulous kids, Eli and Max, glad to be back with you in your first show back.
Chris Veronis.
I'm Chris Veronis. I also head up a communications consulting firm, ASAP Communications Group, where we help clients tell their stories in a way that calls people to action. I live in the city and have been in the communications business for about 17 years.
Dan Johnson.
I'm Dan Johnson. I run a lobbying firm, Progressive Public Affairs. Go to Springfield. This is the best time of the year because all the bills are new. Anything can pass. It's unlimited horizons. The interest groups haven't killed the bills yet, so I love this time of the year in Springfield. Got a family at home, wife and two kids, and my girl Emma's turning one this weekend.
Oh, congratulations. And Mike Miller.
I'm Mike Miller. I'm an associate professor of economics at DePaul University. Been there since 1980. Teach macro, and I assume my students are not listening tonight because they all have midterms tomorrow. So they should be home studying, and I've been married to my wife, Lynn, for 37 years.
Very good. I have spent the last month in the great state of California, and our second caller tonight is from California. Let's go to Fresno. Mike is listening to us on KMJ, one of America's great radio stations. Go ahead, Mike.
Good show, guys.
Thank you.
My son is turning 26 at the end of the month, so he's leaving my policy at work. And they put him on Medi-Cal because he's getting out of school next year. He makes 18 grand a year. Well, he has a health issue that he has to see a specialized doctor. He's been seeing him for 4 years. Well, he called the doctor to rebook his appointment and said, we don't take Medi-Cal. So he called the other six doctors in Fresno to specialize in this problem he's got. They don't want him either. They said, we don't take Medi-Cal. They don't pay any money. And I'll give you an example of what's going on here. If you're a plumber making $60 an hour, you don't take jobs that make $20 an hour. And that's the thing the Democrats don't get. If the doctors don't make any money, they're out of business. You might not like what doctors make, but unless they make good money, they can't afford the malpractice insurance. So when you say you're cutting costs, the only cost you're cutting is to the doctor. So my son now, I'm going to have to pay the personal. I'm still going to pay for him to go to the specialist because I'm a Republican. I pay my own problems. That's something the Democrats will never admit to. Thanks, guys.
You want to react, Dan?
So it sounds like what you're saying is we got to put a lot more money into Medicaid so that Medicaid patients can see the same sort of specialists and physicians that people on private insurance can see. I completely agree with the Republican from Fresno.
Do you switching gears on something? Something the White House sort of leaked something today that they are considering a 3-year extension on Obamacare for people with existing conditions. That was part of the discussions on the Sunday morning shows. Is that another example to you, Dan, that the White House realizes the political problem they have, and they're looking for anything that could kind of push, further expansion of an irate constituency beyond
beyond the next
election.
I
think it's fair.
Beyond the next presidential election.
I think it's fair. There's always a gap, you know, at the risk of redundancy. There's a gap between the bumper sticker narrative and the reality on the ground. And I think it's fair to acknowledge that, yeah, Democrats, we always have a tougher slog because we have to explain how the industry works and we have to explain how government policies actually work and not just boogeymen.
I think it's fair. You have to defend failed programs.
Like what?
Where's the failure? Is the failure the 3 billion plus people who've signed up for Obamacare, even though the first month was a total fiasco? Is the failure the fact that we're on track to actually come close to hitting the 7 million before March 31st? I mean, is the failure that they just reported today that the marketplace policies are 20% less expensive than the employer mandated that you're getting your policies through the employer? I mean, there are all kinds of successes that are going on with Obamacare, but as Dan said, unfortunately, they don't lend themselves to bumper sticker. I'm hoping, because honestly, if I were a Democrat, I would not shy away from Obamacare.
Yeah.
I think you should embrace Obamacare. I think you should explain Obamacare. I think you should have 100 town hall meetings with your constituents and bring in people who are getting coverage who couldn't before, people who are seeing doctors who couldn't before, people who are getting diagnosed because they got preventative care, and they showed up to their doctor and they were diagnosed at stage one instead of stage four.
Especially
I think Democrats should embrace this.
Especially people with diseases.
Dave, I mean, you're a brave man for going down with the ship then, if you're going to embrace Obamacare, because for a program that was just implemented this year, the bad news is endless. And we haven't even talked about the perverse incentive for employers. Why should they add more people to their roles, more workers to their roles, if the healthcare tax is going to kick in for them?
You believe we're turning into a nation of part-time workers? Nobody's going to work more than 30 hours.
This trend has been in motion for decades. And the last 8 years, it's been accelerated. And our anemic growth is evidence of it. The people are choosing not to get into the workforce, either full-time or part-time.
But if people who choose not to get into the workforce are still getting by, because whether it's unemployment insurance, again, hasn't been extended, but you're getting your unemployment insurance, you're getting your Medicare, your Obamacare, what is the incentive to work?
There's less incentive. And Dave, you've got to recognize
What does it do to the country long term?
It reduces the long run potential growth of the economy, our ability to produce. You have fewer people, or people who work fewer hours, or you have people who are less productive. GDP will grow more slowly over time, and without money, you can't do anything. You can't have Medicaid unless there's money to begin with.
The argument that is made every time a Democrat suggests that you increase taxes on the top 1%, every time a Democrat suggests, "Hey, let's have a minimum wage, let's raise the minimum wage," Republicans scream and cry about how the part-time workers are going to go crazy and how this is going to disincentivize people. It doesn't actually work that way in the real world, and it hasn't worked that
minimum way. Minimum wage raises unemployment. But, Dave, you've got to recognize about Obamacare, it isn't exactly only how many millions of people sign up. It is who signs up. If they all went into Medicaid, the states would go broke. If everybody who comes into Obamacare, and we even hit the 7 million, which I don't think we're going to do, if everyone in there is sick or they're old, the whole thing collapses out of
adverse
selection.
But that's not what the insurers are saying. The insurers are saying that they're getting about what they expected.
Even if we hit 3 million, keep in mind how many millions were thrown off of their policies.
We're going to take
another
call.
Net number is less than a half a million.
We're going to go to Steve listening to us in El Paso, Texas. Been a long time since we heard from El Paso. Nice to hear from KTSM tonight. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, good to talk to y'all. Obamacare has hit me particularly hard. For my employer plan, my individual deductible went from $1,200 to $4,200 for each member of my family. The max out of pocket is another $4,400 tacked onto that. It's so bad that I'm going to run out of money next month for routine prescriptions. Also, my monthly premiums went up by $100. So I decided, well, I'll go to the exchanges and see if I can get a better deal. No, it's more expensive there. Not only that, I have to pay for the insurance through the exchanges with after-tax dollars. So I get another 10 or 15% hit on top of it. It's been a disaster. I'm so furious about this whole thing because it's affecting my health and my income.
All right, let's
voted for Obamacare is dead to me. I don't have anything to do with them. Half my friends, I don't talk to them anymore. It's a polarizing effect, and I'm sick over it.
Let's let Dave respond. Dave, do you want this guy to show up for the town hall meeting? You want all these town hall meetings? You want him to show up?
Again, here's always the challenge when you're dealing with a situation like Steve's, is understanding what the actual facts that Steve, that you're confronting. Because I'm not sure I followed. Did you get your insurance before through your employer, and now they're giving you a different plan because of Obamacare? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. The plan changed for the worse because of all the added costs that were tacked on. It's not just me. It's everyone that I'm talking to. The same thing happened. Huge increases in monthly payments, huge increases in deductible, and huge increases in max out-of-pocket, to the point where I shouldn't even go to the doctor. You know, if I just canceled my insurance, that $700 a month I pay for the policy would at least pay for my prescriptions and my wife's prescriptions every month, but then I wouldn't have insurance. There is no solution to this problem for me other than to just quit taking my meds and crawl off and die.
You see, this is the other problem that comes from employer-provided health care.
I really don't want to argue with the Democrats about this.
I get it through the university. I get it pre-tax. My children have to buy it through the exchange. They get it after tax. That's not fair. There should have been something done. Why didn't Mr. Obama
do that first?
Agreed. Why didn't we fix that first? Why didn't we allow us to buy our insurance across state line first? Why didn't we take the 15% who are not insured and set up a separate exchange just for them, including the people with pre-existing conditions, subsidize it through the government, leave the rest of us alone? No, they didn't do that.
Well, wait a
minute. That would have been a solution.
Well, how many
now
bills?
Now we have this mess.
Well, how many bills since Boehner and the Republicans took over the House, how many times have they passed those policies? Well, they haven't yet. Instead, what they said is, we're for pre-Obamacare. We're for the status quo in 2009. We're for, because that's what they voted on 46
repeal.
Times. They said repeal it, which means we want pre-existing conditions to come back to the United States. That's what it means. You got to own it. We don't want people to be on expanded Medicaid. That's what they voted for.
Just create a pool. Just like in Illinois, I have children with pre-existing conditions over 26. They went into a pool. They paid a certain amount of money. Do that for all the people who are uninsurable. Leave the rest alone. Allow us to go over state lines. No, we didn't want to do that. I don't know why.
But if you create a pool for uninsurable people, that is going to be the most god-awful expensive group of insurance.
Of course it is. So you're just making everybody else pay for it. Well, let them pay for it through their taxes instead of making
the ultimate notion of what insurance is. It's about broadening the pool, and that's
what the
whole
argument is
about.
It only works when you force people to buy, which I don't think is a great idea.
You're right.
Gentlemen, we have to pause. 1-800-723-8229. Back from Chicago with more questions and comments. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're going to go back to calls in just a moment. Let's go to Joe in Gurnee. Actually, we're going to do right now. Joe in Gurnee listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead.
Good evening, Bruce. Speaking as a lawyer, with over 2,000 pages of extremely complex legislation that nobody bothered to read, they couldn't possibly have believed that they had a piece of legislation here which would function as they described it. In fact, the only thing that they could be certain of is that it would fail, that it would completely collapse under its own weight. They couldn't have believed it would work. The only other possible explanation is that they thought it was going to fail. Now, what would come after that?
Why would they vote for it if they thought it was going to fail?
Well, they probably thought it was going to get kicked out by the Supreme Court, and that's why they didn't bother to fix up the website so it would really function.
But the Supreme Court decision came before the website.
But they did intend for it to fail. They had something that could not possibly work, and they knew it couldn't possibly work.
Well, Joe, it is working. And the question is always, would this make things better? Not will this be perfect? Because we acknowledge nothing is ever perfect. But for Republicans to claim that the health industry
doesn't sell anymore.
We don't
know
that it's working.
Well, if you'd like, you can advocate going back to pre-Obamacare, where pre-existing conditions are back, and you can't get insurance if you got a disease, and insurance companies can kick you off once you spend $1 million and you're out of luck.
And you go bankrupt if you have a health care problem and you're uninsured.
If you like that, then you're going to love what the House Republicans have been voting for.
Fate. That's what it's there for. It's a way to get out from under debt. When someone declares bankruptcy, they're just waving bye-bye to their creditors. You know, it's the creditor's problem, not the individual bankruptees.
Well, they go bankrupt because they got a disease and they can't pay their hospital and doctor bills and they lose all their assets and money and then they declare bankruptcy. I don't think that's a way to run a country, but
money
maybe
all the time. That's the way life is, and it's always going to be that way.
Not anymore.
And
that's why it's working.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's why
it's
doing.
Awesome.
The doctors are quitting their practices early.
Yeah.
You may
until
have health care insurance.
Right.
You may not
right.
have health care.
It has to do with the probability of payout versus the premium. If all the people who are signed up are the wrong kinds of people, it is going to fail.
But
you have to hope
failing.
That everybody who is in there does not get sick and pays a premium that is consistent with their illnesses.
We're going to move on. Joe, thanks very much for your call. We've got a few minutes left in this this section of the show, and I do want to talk about another issue, and that is Victoria Nuland. She is the U.S. diplomat who tweeted or was heard as tweeting, suggesting that the EU should F the EU. That has created quite a stir with our allies. Again, we have a U.S. diplomat creating problems with our allies. And my question is, she appears to be a person that's going to keep her job. Should she keep her job, Chris? Is this a fireable offense?
Well, first of all, I mean, this sort of sounds like shades of the Bush State Department or Bush Foreign Affairs. You know, ironic that it's a member of the Obama administration. But
the one exception is, had it been a Bush person doing this, it would have been the dominance of every Sunday show today.
Oh,
and Meet the Press.
Poppycock. I think there's
Meet
something
the Press
that.
Spent but, about 40 seconds on the subject.
And to your question, I'd say it's she apologized. I think she handled it well in the wake of the revelation. But it's kind of ridiculous and immoral in a lot of ways that this whole thing got leaked out to begin
exactly.
with.
Exactly.
I mean, let's face it.
The Soviet? Do you think the Russians did
Russians,
it?
Yeah,
yeah
Russians,
everyone says the Russians did it. And honestly, I think people say how a whole lot worse.
She was having a private phone call that was bugged by the Russians, leaked because the Russians don't like her because she's been aggressive. And now we're talking about, well, should she be fired? And frankly, if you heard the context of what she said, it really wasn't that big a deal. She said, oh, well, we'll be able to get this accomplished through the UN instead of through the EU. So after the EU.
Diplomatic.
Like, you know, it wasn't diplomatic, but it wasn't a public conversation. It was a private, internal conversation.
What was she doing on an unencrypted phone, though? It's my
no, it was an encrypted phone.
No,
wasn't
my
it?
Understanding is that was not.
Okay, so there's her sin.
That's
what
how
is the
her
reaction,
sin is talking on an unencrypted
phone. If anyone
phone.
Has a reaction, what is the reaction to the opening ceremonies the other evening when the Olympics opened and generally how Vladimir Putin is handling the Olympics thus far? Dan.
I find the Olympics, the idea of them so inspiring that for a century, the people of the world, even if there's talk of war, they still get together just for fun.
And go through metal detectors.
The Olympics have been suspended before.
I mean, sure, but just the idea that with all the tensions in the world, that Iran and the U.S., you know, put aside that we're getting closer, right? But it's just wonderful. It's just a wonderful institution. Wow. I find it boring to watch, but I think the idea of it is really inspiring.
What does it say that Vladimir Putin was able to deliver the Olympics to Russia, but Obama couldn't?
It says that the IOC likes to stick it to the Americans because who did the last two
Nobel Peace Prize?
Who did the last two? Who did the last two Olympics go to? They went to China and Russia. Thank you, IOC, for highlighting the most progressive regimes in the world. And look at what Putin did.
They've spent
$50 billion rather than investing it in its in their people.
Oh, yeah.
They invested it in these horrific facilities with the brown water and the doors that get locked so Olympic athletes have to punch their way out of the bathrooms. I mean, yes, I agree with Dan. The Olympics are inspiring from the athletes. And you know, I was watching ski jumping today. It's fascinating. But, oh, good grief. Can we stop making political statements with where we put our Olympics?
But it's also funny that the in the opening ceremony, there was apparently a glitch in some of the lighting. But the people in Russia did not see that. They interspersed stuff from the practice so that the people in Russia did not know that.
That's what B-roll's for, baby.
I think that's fabulous.
Only in Mother Russia.
Only
well, again, let us hope they get through the Olympics without any
yes, absolutely.
terrorism certainly has been the dominant story more than anything else, more than the
gold
medals.
And shooting dogs.
And on that note, we are out of time for this first hour of our broadcast. Everyone will be back on the left side tonight. We have David Lundy and we have Dan Johnson. On the right side, we've got Chris Varonis and Mike Miller, and they will all be back for another full hour of Beyond the Beltway. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. And again, if you're watching us on television in Chicago, we are on later than we used to be. We used to be on at 10:30. I'd really like to be back at 10:30, not at midnight. So if you feel that same way, you call WYCC tomorrow and ask them to put the show back on at 10:30 when more people will be awake. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly with another hour. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrats Dan Johnson and Dave Lundy, and Republicans Mike Miller and Chris Varonis. Our program tonight comes to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Our email address is btb@museum.tv. If you want to join us on the web, our web address is beyondthebeltway.com. And if you want to tweet us a question, it's at BTB Dumont, at BTB Dumont, if you want to tweet us a question for this coming discussion. We have been talking thus far about the problems with the Congressional Budget Office and their assessment of Obamacare. But one of the other big stories recently has been John Boehner. A couple of weeks ago, he said that he thought that immigration reform would be on the agenda, congressional agenda, something he wanted to get done this year. But then this past week, he sort of backed away from that, suggesting that basically it can wait, giving as an excuse that House Republicans can't trust President Obama. They feel that regardless of whatever law is passed, the president is not going to enforce that law. So even if they make it real strong and strict, that's the rationale they're using. And so immigration continues to be a political football. Chris Varonis, you've been on this program before. I know you favor a path to citizenship. You favor a more progressive or moderate or however establishment Republican view on this. Is this an issue that for political purposes, not what's good for the country, but for political purposes, maybe it's best that the Republicans not deal with this issue this year? Save it to 2015.
You know, John Cronin made a comment, and there might be something to this comment, that that Republicans don't need immigration reform to win in 2014, but they need it to win in 2016.
Right.
There is a lot of truth to that, and it's just the reality that I think a lot of Republicans have embraced, whether they say it publicly or not. The whole thing with Boehner last week, I do not believe that the final chapters have been written on immigration reform in 2014. I think it's just part of high-stakes negotiations and the kabuki dance that is Washington politics.
Dan Johnson, your view on this issue and the way the Republicans are playing the card right now?
I think it's a bad long-term hand to be against immigration reform. I think it's great for Democrats to have been leading on this issue. I think Republicans that see the future of the country embrace it, and those that don't care so much about the 2 or 4 or 6 year game don't. But having said that, enough of the House Republicans are ensconced in these super red districts where they don't really care whether something's good for the country as it relates to immigration reform.
Right.
And it doesn't play well with those Republican primary voters. So the dynamics within the Republican caucus, there's enough of them where for them back home with some people that just don't like some of the people that are going to be citizens if we pass this thing, it's tough to, educate.
So politically, they're making a smart move, because you're right. What they need in 2014, they want to get elected to Congress. The people that elect them to Congress are people that do not like the idea of a pathway to citizenship.
Yeah.
So why should they swallow the poison pill and do that this year? The issue of the lack of Hispanic support for Republicans as a party is at the presidential level.
And
the Senate. But again, it doesn't, at least at this particular moment, because of Obamacare, it seems to me that in many states, and by the way, the Senate has already voted, they've already rendered their verdict on what they want to do. So the safe Republicans are going to be safe. Mark Kirk in Illinois, I think, is going to be, not in any political problem. Not that he's up this year, but I'm just saying he's not in a political problem. There's a lot of other Republicans
at the Senate level. Yeah, Kirk
are okay,
yeah.
But politically speaking, this is a smart move, right, Dave?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, let me clarify. It's a smart move for them to stay away from immigration reform this year.
Right.
Politically,
right.
It was not a smart move for John Boehner to say he was for it before he was against it, and then to blame being against it on, well, we just can't trust this president to do anything and to enforce our laws.
But
frankly, that was given the number of people that Barack Obama has deported, a number of undocumented workers, he has deported far more than George W. Bush. It is a supremely offensive bit of rhetoric.
But. To those people who are voting in Republican primaries.
That's the point.
It's red meat.
To say that they don't trust the president, that's real popular.
Right.
It's red meat to the red states.
Because this is the president that promised one thing on Obamacare and didn't deliver on it. Mike,
exactly right.
And
two things about it. One is that they may have a stronger hand in 2015 if they win the Senate. Then the president has to deal with the Republicans. He has no choice but to deal with them. And secondly, I guess I'm somewhat with Chris here. I'm very much a fan of immigration. All I ask is you come through the front door. And I think that the Republicans have got to get something where we secure the border, where we have absolute proof. I understand you want to say about all the deportations and so forth. But the issue is that a law is passed and then the president just because he thinks he's king or something, decides, well, this part of the law doesn't count anymore. We're going to push this aside. That's what they're fearful of.
Unlike the signing statements of George W. Bush.
They're all wrong.
Or expanding DOMA rights.
Exactly
right.
That's
an executive decision that he made,
right.
Which is popular in some states, but a lot of states don't like that.
He enforces what he wants in the law.
Every president does.
And they should not.
Every president does.
We'll put the
stop to it right here. But you cannot say that on immigration. You can't say that on immigration. There's zero evidence. And furthermore, I believe the stat is, and Dan, maybe you have it, I believe we're at something around net zero undocumented immigration in this country right now because the borders have been secured by the president.
More to it than that,
you're assuming. Remember, holding things constant. Yes.
Our economy is floundering, and they're actually Mexican economy happens to be growing. So they're not coming here anymore.
Take a look what happened on Friday.
Done a lot
take a look
to secure
at that labor data on Friday as well.
Today on television, Chuck Schumer suggested, a Democrat of New York, he suggested that the Republicans pass immigration reform this year, but don't make it the law of the land until after the 2016 election.
He was just calling their bluff. He was calling their bluff.
Isn't that a good idea, Chris?
I think there's something to that. And frankly, the issues that separate parties' consensus of vote, they're eminently doable.
The only reason why it's not a good idea, it's common sense. It makes sense. The reason it's not a good idea is it doesn't address those people who are running in Republican primaries who may be fearing a Republican concern because they don't want the bill passed at all.
That's why they should wait till after the primaries.
They should wait.
They should.
Over 60% of the Republicans come from districts with less than 10% Hispanic voters.
Right.
So they got
nothing
to lose.
You see that here in Illinois.
But the white
as well.
Business people are starting to say, look, I understand xenophobia. I understand, a little racism here.
Oh,
but this is bad for the economy with a broken immigration system, and it's time for some Republican leadership. And you heard Denny Hastert say that. And you've heard the Chamber of Commerce say that. And so the establishment
the big business people in 2014 are going to write the big checks to the Republicans because they think they're going to expand their control in the House and they're going to take over the Senate. And so even though they may not like all the rabble-rousing that's out there from your perspective, they're going to write their big checks because big business, they go with the winners.
Well,
and usually they are on both sides.
So they go with the party that represents their interests.
That's
why you have to call it.
Republicans, because they figure that they're going to have to be dealing with a Republican speaker and perhaps a Republican majority leader in the Senate. 1-800-723-8020. Where do you come down on illegal immigration? Should we crack down on it? Should we expand it? Should we have a pathway to citizenship? And do you want it done? And maybe you don't want it done at all. Back shortly from Chicago.
nonsense.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for being with us today. One of the things I want to ask our Democrats, David Plouffe was on one of the shows today. He was on with on ABC. And he was giving sort of advice to the Republicans. I always amuse when Democrats give advice to, or vice versa. But basically, he seemed to be going over backwards that the Republicans really should get on and pass this immigration reform. They have really got to get on. Why would a Democrat want to suggest that the Republicans do something that if they were to do it, it might make them a little more competitive and a little more likely to be appreciated by Hispanics?
I think on this one, sometimes you ask for leadership. And I think immigration for the advocates has taken on this this sense of a moral crusade. Besides how smart it is, how good it is for the economy, how stupid the status quo is, there's something moral, I think, among advocates that we are destroying families with this absurd policy. And I think, you know, Plouffe may be part of it now, almost begging, because there is a majority in the House to vote for it, begging for a little leadership to do the right thing for the country. Because it would not be a good idea to give good political advice to the other team on how to win an election.
I don't know if I'd take advice from David Plouffe. No. I mean, I'd probably do the opposite. The reality is, this is the right thing to do on so many different levels. Economic, social,
moral.
But
the timing may not be right.
But the timing may not be right. And the reality is, and I say this as a Republican, it will be costly to Republicans in elections in the short term, but it's a necessary shock to the system for the party to become competitive and speak to this segment of the electorate who really is socially conservative.
But how does, again, if we go through an entire year where immigration reform is not passed, there's no form. Yeah. Okay.
The window they're saying is May, when the majority of the primary okay. calendar is winding
down.
So then
things change, and then all of a sudden, how believable is it going to be to the Hispanic voters out there? How believable is it going to be when Republicans are like the last ones to jump on this train, and then in 2015 and 2016 saying, we loved you all the time, we really want... Can they erase the perception that they've been blocking immigration reform?
Yes, they can.
Absolutely.
Yes, they can.
Absolutely.
With time. And also, I really don't buy into the calcified opposition in the Republican Party. There's probably like a 60-40 split, but there's serious conservative support for immigration reform that ranges from Paul Ryan of the Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm. We must recognize as well that there is a distinction between legal immigration and illegal immigration. And I think that the thing that separates the Republicans from the Democrats has to do with that particular issue, that the Republicans have this thing about coming in the back door and then receiving social benefits from it, as opposed to coming in through the front door, through legal immigration. Most of the Republicans I speak to are people who are completely embracing of immigration. They just don't like the idea of people breaking the law to get here and then receiving benefits that we have to pay for in the first place.
But the last time we were all together, we were talking about Chris Christie and that he was the darling of the establishment wing of the Republican Party. A lot has happened to Chris Christie since we had that discussion, including he had another bad week. He's had some real bad weeks. Last week was a real bad week when the New York Times revealed, an allegation by one of his staffers that indeed he knew about the bridge closing in question that's caused all the Bridgegate controversy. And then someone on his staff, allegedly not with his knowledge, then went out and issued, was spreading rumors and rumors and innuendo about Mr. Wildman, who was the person that made the charges, trying to besmirch his reputation. I think you were the one, Mike, when we talked about this a long time ago, because I think you were on the show when the subject first came up. Were you the one that said you thought that if it became known that Christie knew about the bridge closings in advance, you said he would be toast?
He would be toast. Absolutely.
Is he toast?
I don't know the truth. Does anybody around the table know the truth? Did he know ahead of time? If he did, he's a lie to us.
But he's
already
lied
to our face. He should not be a presidential candidate.
But he's already been demonstrated to be a liar, because he said in his press conference, He said, you know, I barely even know David Wildstein. I maybe have talked to him five times in the last 5 years. And then the next day, the Wall Street Journal puts out a photograph of him and Wildstein having a conversation on September 11th, the day the bridges are closed.
But keep it,
there were lie after lie after lie is, that Chris Christie
I'm
has
talking about
has,
a major
has told.
Lie. He said he wasn't.
He's toast anyway.
And let's keep in mind that lying doesn't necessarily ruin your career. All you have to do is ask
Bill Clinton. Yes,
he lied, and he was still Bill Clinton.
He's doing pretty well right now.
Or Barack Obama.
Yeah.
There's a difference. As a Chris Christie fan, I would say that the whole Bridgegate thing is troubling. And if it comes out that he ordered, his nascent presidential run just might as well be canceled.
Even if he didn't order it.
But he knew about it.
Now
yeah.
it's if That's he right. ordered it. Right, yeah. And the next thing is to say, well, you know, if he went out there and actually put the stand on and stopped it,
if
maybe
in fact,
we
that was
stop.
The one true thing he was saying at his press conference. I was the guy who went banning the cones. But look, here's the thing. I don't know, Chris. Do you actually believe that Chris Christie's presidential ambitions are still alive? I mean, I think he's done. I think he's toast. I think far more important than the Bridgegate controversy is what's going on with Sandy funds, all these stories that are breaking, not just about Don Zimmer, but also about how the state that had the 250th most damage got $6 million to build a senior center out of Sandy funds, and there's no accountability. I mean, I'm telling you, Chris Christie is toast as a national figure, and he'll be lucky to survive as governor.
There's another
he's got 4 years to survive.
There's another political candidate who they said was toast in 1992. And 8 years later,
well,
he's one of the most popular.
I knew Bill
presidents.
Clinton. Bill Clinton was
one of the most
Chris Christie
popular.
No, Bill Clinton.
Dan Johnson. I think from the start, the presidential ambitions were oversold. I think the idea that the Republican electorate's going to embrace a Northeast politician is
never
absurd.
A serious candidate.
He was like he's like the Rudy Giuliani of a few years back.
You're so correct
that the New York media loves him. Right, he gets a lot of play, but that Republican base. They don't like Northeast politicians.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk about red meat. Let's talk about another name, because a name that's popped up with the declining popularity of Chris Christie, or at least the viability, at least based on the five people around this table, and that is Mike Huckabee. Mike Huckabee is sort of back. There was a recent poll that came out that he was in first place in a preference poll in Republican primaries, and yet he said some things that have riled up the liberal Eastern establishment and some Democrats. Is there anything that Mike Huckabee has said in the last month, Mike Miller, that you think has retarded his opportunity to become the Republican nominee?
I just wonder if during that speech he had not used the word libido, that would make all the difference. I heard the thing in context. I read the paragraphs before and the paragraphs after, and what he said was perfectly reasonable. But why he had to bring up about women who can't control their libido, and that's why they need to have the government pay for their contraception. When he brought that up, that kind of took his basic point and ruined it. And that's why I always – one thing I fear every time I come to do the show, am I going to have that night where I say that stupid thing that is forever on Twitter or something because of what I said?
But you'll be invited back the next week, even if you do.
Especially if you do.
You might even become even on more often. But Chris.
Look, he's got to wear this. I think he knew what he was saying. I think he was going for the soundbite. I don't think he's a viable Republican contender.
Why not?
But at the same time, if you – I've read some of his speeches. He's a pretty thoughtful conservative.
Very thoughtful. Yeah.
Very thoughtful.
Bright.
Very affable.
He's
very likable.
He is absolutely a viable candidate. I think he'll be one of the top two or three in 16. He fits that base
this
like a
like
glove.
This is like David Plouffe giving advice again.
You actually want him to
Did
be
David
the
Plouffe
candidate.
No,
on
look.
The show?
You've sent some money to his draft campaign.
Right.
We want Huckabee.
Yeah. Right, don't you? It's like 40% of the base. That's Mike Huckabee, right? He represents not a majority.
How
of Republican
bad do Republicans want immigration reform, Dan?
Not that badly, man. Not that badly.
Look, I think the 2016 Republican field is a disaster. It's a total disaster there because notwithstanding that Mike Huckabee surged to the lead with 17% over Rand Paul with 16%. In that poll, Rand Paul is not going to wear well over the long haul. And if that is their guy, if that's their candidate, I think the Republican Party is
in deep,
deep
trouble. Tell me why you think he will not wear well over the long haul in a Republican primary.
No, I'm saying in a general election. in a general election.
So he could
get the Republican
nomination.
Oh, sure. It's an open field. I mean, right now it's a pick 'em race. I wouldn't put my money on
anybody. There isn't an establishment candidate.
Here's my point. Now let's go from the rhetoric that he's throwing out. We're talking about someone that's throwing out red meat. And again, you've heard me say on this particular program that I think Rand Paul is the guy to beat for the Republican primary because the first three places, I think Rand Paul could run very well. I think he could do well in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina for a variety of reasons. I think he's also a little fearful to Democrats because in a general election, because of his position sort of on drugs and a lot of
NSA.
Libertarian stuff,
yep.
I think he has the ability to expand the base and to get people who don't vote, not only vote Democratic, but people who don't vote at all, because he's going to be so vilified by the media and everyone else. Yeah. He could catch lightning because his father's been able to do that.
Yeah,
again,
right.
He hasn't won a primary, but I'm just saying is I think he's a softer, more articulate, more fresh face to talk about it. But when he said a couple of weeks ago, and he repeated it today, in talking about that Bill Clinton, if Hillary runs, Bill Clinton is an issue, describing him over and over again as a sexual predator. That's how he's described Bill Clinton.
Right.
I want to talk about the wisdom of saying that. And by saying that, is that the third rail, which will absolutely, it will drive the left and the media apoplectic. But it's something that a lot of people in this country, Republican primary voters, absolutely, positively believe. They believe that Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton are locked. It's you vote for one, you get the other. And again, his background and his track record are all part of the record for 2016. Back shortly with your comments. All right, we are back. We had a wonderful little commercial break there. Again, nice to have you with us tonight. Good to be back in home base in Chicago doing our broadcast this evening. And let us introduce our guest. And by the way, let me just say, when I listen and watch all the Sunday morning shows, they all talk about our power roundtable and our power this and our roundtable this. I want to tell you, this is going to be the new motto of this show. This is the only political show with an actual round table. There are square tables on ABC. There are Pentagon tables. There's octagonal. There's circular. This is the only. And again, our director, before we go off the air, our director is going to show you exactly what I'm talking about. We have the only talk show that is a real round table. And again, every Sunday night, you can find it right here. Dave Lundy, introduce yourself to our guests.
I run a communications and public affairs strategy firm called Aileron. I've got a wife, Jen, two fabulous kids, Eli and Max, and delighted to be back with you, Bruce.
And Chris Veronis.
I also run a communications firm. It'll be 3 years and a couple months. And
Aesop Communications.
Aesop Communications Group. And I do not compete with Dave and never would. And in full disclosure, by the way, I have a pro-reform immigration client.
Good. Okay. And Dan Johnson.
I'm a lobbyist, primarily in the Illinois General Assembly. Company's called Progressive Public Affairs. And delighted to be here.
And tell everyone about your famous brother.
So my younger brother, Jake, is the love interest of Zooey Deschanel in Fox's hit comedy, The New Girl. Tuesdays at 9, 8 central.
Very good. And he looks very much like you.
He'll be appearing this summer in the Damon Wayans, Jake Johnson buddy movie, Let's Be Cops.
And I hope he makes a visit to the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
We're going
to
make that happen.
We gave him a private tour one night. It was nice to have him with him. And again, he was all over the Super Bowl with a promo, so congratulations.
Yeah.
By the way, let me just ask one follow-up. You obviously knew him when he was born and ball and all that stuff. I mean, but you knew that obviously he was an actor. He was young, struggling actor. Everyone else. When did you first say to yourself, "Oh my God, my brother's he's a hit"?
I thought he would get on television. He's a great head for business. You know, show business. There's a lot of business to it. He's got a great head for business, and so when he and he decided, I'm going to do the pilot with Zooey Deschanel. Before, you know, there was some question like, is Zooey Deschanel going to be a good sitcom star? And I thought, that's going to be a home run. So once he got that pilot booked, I thought, man, this guy may actually be noticed.
Look out, Rahm and the other Emmanuel.
Yeah, right.
Not Zeke.
Yeah, the Emmanuel brothers.
Yeah, look out.
Right.
Look out.
Oh, yeah, right.
Politics
right.
in Hollywood.
We're coming.
Yeah, that's right. You guys
Mike Miller
town.
Joins us also from DePaul University.
Yeah, I'm an economist at DePaul and a product of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And in addition to my wife, I've been married to for 37 years. I have two sons.
I said before the break that Rand Paul has said for the last couple of weeks that Hillary Clinton, if she is the candidate in 2016, that the actions of her husband will also be front and center in a campaign. They should be discussed. He went on and on talking about the Republicans are always charged that they are waging a war on women. He suggested that Bill Clinton has waged his own war on women and has described him on more than one occasion, including recently today, as a sexual predator. And all the mess and all the grit and grim side of the Clinton administration will be brought up and will be fodder in the 2016 campaign if Hillary Clinton is running. And again, when I use that as the setup to this segment, Dave, you can't wait to hit this out of the ballpark.
If Republicans want to bring us back to the 90s, talk about 20 million jobs created and the first balanced budget under a Democratic president.
I think there's only one job that Rand Paul is talking about.
I think you're right, Bruce. No, look, I saw when he went on Meet the Press and did that, and I laughed. I actually laughed out loud when I watched that. Look, nobody's going to excuse Bill Clinton's behavior with women, least of all me.
That's not true.
No.
At the time.
No, Mike, that wasn't what it was about. And if you want to relive the 90s and the impeachment, I'm happy to. Because the impeachment was what backfired. As usual, Republicans overreached.
I'm not rebutting. If they want to do this, that's what they're going to happen again.
I don't think that's what Rand Paul was talking about. What Rand Paul was talking about was not the impeachment, not the 90s. He was talking about whether or not the personality trait of Bill Clinton, that he's a sexual predator, that it's everyone knows that he has used his position with an intern. And the question is, will that be a legitimate part of a discussion in a general election if Hillary is the candidate?
Because when you get Hillary, you get him. And at the time, the women of the Democrats said it was absolutely not sexual harassment. But in his own memoir, Bill Clinton said the reason he did it is because he could. Which is almost the exact definition of what sexual harassment is, that a person in power, because they can, does. They do it. The women at the time, I was surrounded by them and within the university. No one would take the position that this was sexual harassment. So I agree. Now, in retrospect, you're beginning to see that this, in fact, was. And the way he treated Kathleen Willey and all these different women that he was accused of attacking, and whatever word you want to use, he is a bit of a predator.
Is it fair game to talk about the spouse of a candidate for president?
Well, this is maybe new rules because the spouse is a former president. It's never been that.
Yeah,
before.
It's totally fair.
Otherwise,
game.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, so it's fair game if they choose to do it.
It's fair game to talk about Bill Clinton, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't like it, but I think it's a pretty powerful move on Rand Paul's part. I think
because it's true.
Well,
I think so too.
Look, there's a real problem with Bill Clinton's sexual past. But why it's so smart is because Democrats have such a strong hand to play for women voters on the issues. But this one can trump it. It's kind of like people talking about Woody Allen now. Yep. And like right now people are like, wait a minute, I used to love those movies, but he's disgusting.
Yeah.
Right? And it changes things.
Yes, it does.
And so it's a smart,
very smart,
powerful move because all of our natural inclinations to get our family-friendly policies and we do better and we invest in education, that's a real anchor they can hang around our necks with that Clinton's Bill Clinton.
I agree,
stuff.
And I agree with you, Dave, that this was not, when he said it a couple of weeks ago on Meet the Press, it was not a flippant off the
right.
Well, and
it was a calculated response because it was chapter verse chapter verse chapter verse.
You can debate the merits of impeaching the president, but again, that's not what this was. No. It was a statement of the fact, more or less. And I think what makes it hurt even more is that Bill Clinton really didn't do much in the way of rehabilitation when he left the presidency. With a lot of his behavior, the Vanity Fair article that came out, some of the unseemly characters he's hanging around with, and a lot of this is earned. And like Mike says, when you get Hillary, you get the president, and we've got new rules here.
I believe Bill Clinton's approval rating currently is somewhere in the upper 60s. He was the greatest asset the president had. What the strategy is about, and I disagree with
because nobody's
with Dan
reminding people of some of the baggage, though.
Right.
No, but, I mean, the people that are spending, you know, $150,000 to have him give a speech or more, they don't care about this. They really don't. And they don't care. The Democratic left doesn't care. Women in the Democratic Party don't care. But the point is, if Rand, by saying what he said, Rand Paul is speaking to many people who are Republican primary voters who don't forget.
But that's not what the point of what he did was. The point of what he did was it was to try to neutralize Bill Clinton this year and in 2016. It was an attempt to try to neuter him, to try to get him to tone it down. It will fail. I am telling you, this is not going to work. It will be. It is going to be an overreach. And at the end of the day, Democrats will rally, and women who don't like the conduct have managed to reconcile that in their own in their own minds.
I will agree.
I don't know if they have.
I think
not women that I know.
I think there's very few Republican primary voters have reconciled the conduct. I think you're right that Bill Clinton is an exceptional politician and will still be an asset to the party.
I don't know, but I don't know. I challenge that. If he was an exceptional, this is a guy who had everything in 2008. He was calling all the shots in the campaign. His wife, she was miles ahead in the race for president.
No, that's fair.
And the two of them together, they screwed up. They blew the presidency in 2008.
And they learned from their mistakes.
Worst run presidential campaign.
It was a horrible campaign.
That's fair.
Well, then how has this guy continued to be a genius? Why does every Democrat call him up as a genius?
Did you see the 2012 convention speech?
I think
the 2012 convention speech was brilliant.
Yeah, they
were absolutely brilliant.
Well, great, because he wasn't talking about himself or his wife, and it was probably vetted by somebody at the White House.
No, actually, he wrote a speech, and the speech he delivered was double the length of the one that was vetted.
But one other thing, because what else are you going to attack Hillary for? Right now, she looks incredible.
Benghazi.
Right?
Benghazi.
Exceptional, right? She's looking great.
Why?
Why?
Well,
Benghazi.
She was a great Secretary of State.
Name one thing that she did as Secretary of State that warrants the title great. Just one.
I would say, first of all, following the president's lead, but retreating from the war in Iraq, retreating from the war in Afghanistan, and warming up relations in Iran.
Careful about your campaign slogans.
Yeah, watch the word retreat.
All right, fine. Thank you. Right. That's fine.
We retreated.
And you tell me if a year from now, Iran has the bomb, if it turned out to be a good deal to deal with the Iranians.
And by the way, thank goodness those people that were trying to kill this deal in the Congress between Iran and Obama were unsuccessful. Thank goodness for peace on earth. But
really?
Hillary's contributions to warming up Iran, the election of the first moderate in Iran in, 25, 30 years?
Moderate.
After, right?
She gets all the credit for that.
No, but if she played a role, good for her. Absolutely good for her.
And if she played a role in Benghazi, bad for her.
I think it's overplayed. I think it's oversold. I don't think it's that big a deal.
Four dead people.
Well, hey, who cares?
Big deal.
Who cares? As she said, who cares?
That's not what she was talking about.
I think she did. We'll have to look at the tape.
Look at the tape.
Shortly, 1-800-723-8289. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us, Dan Johnson. You wanted to make a point about another further point about Rand Paul's.
I think his leadership attacking the NSA overreach is great politics, both in the Republican primary to bring in younger people, and also if he makes it, I think that's going to play real well in November.
Yeah, see, I think the young vote could make a difference in the university. There are so few Republicans that I'm a mentor for several groups, and one is the Young Americans for Liberty, which would be the libertarians. And the numbers are growing. I think there are a lot of students who respond very positively to his message. Small government, stay out of the foreign entanglements and so forth, and I think he has a good shot.
I made the point a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about Rand Paul and NSA, is that he has the ability to expand the base and reach out to people who don't vote.
Yeah.
Do you think he has any possibility of reaching out to people who are Democratic voters, who are Democratic left voters, would they give him a chance, or just because he happens to be a Republican, would they not?
Right up until he talks about how we shouldn't have passed the Civil Rights Act and the public accommodations, and that there's no right in the Constitution to all these things, and then he'll lose them. Rand Paul has said Rand Paul will be superficially attractive, just like Ron Paul was to the far left of the Democratic Party, but it won't last because a lot of what Rand Paul believes is so diametrically opposed to left wing Democrats, and I think it has no staying power.
What about to the non-voters?
Again, you know, there are some things people like Rand Paul and his father can get people riled up and attracted to him briefly. And the question is, the thing I like about American presidential campaigns is that they're long. It's what typical voters hate is what I like. It allows you to expose the crazy. It's the reason Ross Perot was never elected president. Had we had a two-month campaign, Ross Perot would have been president of this country.
Yep.
And we'd have elected a lot of crazies. I, frankly, put Rand Paul in that category, and I think that Rand Paul has 26 different chapters of crazy, and a long enough campaign will expose them all.
Well, let me follow up on that, because I think about a fifth of the electorate, 20% or so, they're real independent-minded, and they like third party, they like independence, they like something different.
Yep.
And those folks, call them non-voters if you want, they come out when there's another alternative, and I think Rand Paul is right up that alley. I think you're right that the two-thirds of his positions are going to alienate a lot of people. But he does draw a lot of people into those Republican primaries. You could see it in 8 and 12 when there'd be like, you know, 20-year-olds that are like hackers that are going to a caucus. And they're like, yeah, I'm here for Ron Paul. You know, and there is a constituency there, 5, 10, 15, 20%-ish. But it's real. It kind of draws people into the Republican Party. And there's not a lot of that happening in the Republican
Party. If we are going to, as we said in the last segment, if we think that it's fair for at least the policies and personal imperfections of Bill Clinton to be fodder in a campaign, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, if Rand Paul is the nominee, does he have to answer for everything that his father has said?
I think that's different. Yeah. I think it's different. His father is older. He is retired. I mean, his father is yesterday.
Right.
And one does not have to answer for one's parent the same way one answers for one's spouse. Like ask about Ted Cruz and his dad.
Like when Chelsea inevitably runs for something, the anti-Bill Clinton stuff won't apply.
No, nope.
It's just,
it shouldn't.
Right.
Absolutely.
When we, by the way, obviously around the country, there's been a move in a couple of states to make recreational marijuana legal in Colorado and in the state of Washington. The pendulum towards use of medical marijuana is growing, including in the state of Illinois. So there is a move, a libertarian strain that's out there that is suggesting that maybe there's a relaxation of marijuana, the way marijuana is treated legislatively in this country. To what extent did the overdose of Philip Seymour Hoffman on heroin in New York, does that blunt a swing, even though we're talking about heroin and marijuana? Does that blunt a political movement, because there already has been and there likely is going to continue to be a focus on the growing heroin epidemic in the country? And does that sort of stop the logical flow of serious discussions of marijuana legalization?
I sure hope so. I'm a Democrat and I'm a progressive, and I favor tightly regulated medical marijuana because I know of situations where that would be of value. But I think the legalization of marijuana in this country is a fundamental mistake. I think we will regret it. I think Colorado will regret it. And I think that if the Philip Seymour Hoffman tragedy will expose the perils of gateway drugs and the addiction problems that ensue after that, I think then something positive can come out of a horrible situation.
Yeah, but we have the advantage of these states. That's the nice thing about having states. We'll watch and see what happens. And I've never used it. I think it's stupid to use it, but I'm not sure what role the government has in regulating it.
I think it will, in the medium term, help distinguish between – I'm going to disagree with my friend Dave. I think there's a world of difference between the marijuana and harder drugs. I think it will help draw the distinction between these drugs that are immediately addicting and devastating and those drugs which are like marijuana, which is less of an impact than alcohol. And I think it will I hope that people will start to separate marijuana from drugs generally and start to say we need a more reasonable policy about marijuana.
Well, the president certainly tried to do
that. It helped.
But his head of the DEA disagreed with him.
And I'm closer to Dave. Introducing that kind of temptation for someone in their formative years, it's just a recipe for recklessness. Aside from the compelling evidence of marijuana's impact on brain development in teenaged kids, it's pretty compelling evidence.
On that note, we are out of time. By the way, in the next couple of weeks, when the program will be returning to California for a couple of weeks, we will have a discussion of this issue of a whole hour or maybe even 2 hours on the movement to legalize drugs around the country. So if you're interested in that subject, we will have a full 2 hours on it coming up in a couple of weeks. Our thanks to Dave Lundy and to Dan Johnson for being with us. They've been representing the Democratic Party, not the party, but all things progressive.
Right.
And our conservative Republican guests this evening have been Chris Veronis and Mike Miller. We thank you all for being with us. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Dan Dorfman and Tom Veracruz for their assistance in the production of this program. And until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.